In the pre-dawn darkness of a misty September morning in 1780, the premier combat officer of the Continental Army, Benedict Arnold, said farewell to a young British officer and headed back home along the banks of the Hudson River. Major General Arnold, commander of the American fortress at West Point, had just handed over information vital to the enemy's planned attack of the fort, then called the key to the continent. If West Point fell, the revolution would be over and Americans would remain subjects of the British Empire.
Benedict Arnold was a man who fought heroically, who sacrificed a great deal, who was a superb leader in many respects, and then went over to the very side that he had been fighting against. And this was unforgivable in the eyes of most of his contemporaries and remains that way for most Americans today.
Benedict Arnold's name has become synonymous with treason. To the average American, Arnold and traitor mean the same thing. Thus, no one names their son Benedict in America.
If the musket ball that shattered his thigh bone in Saratoga had entered his heart instead of his leg, he'd be remembered today as one of this country's greatest heroes. We would have cities named after him, there'd be a state named Arnold, there'd be monuments to him all over the place.
But we as a nation should celebrate that which he did for us, because none of us would be living under the American flag if there hadn't been a Benedict Arnold.
First arriving from England in 1651, four generations of Arnolds carved out the wild frontier of New England, helping to settle the state of Rhode Island. Benedict's father, Benedict III, was compelled to apprentice himself and learn the trade of barrel making, which served him well in an economy based on trading and shipping. Looking to make more money, he left Rhode Island and in 1730 moved to the booming port town of Norwich, Connecticut.
Norwich was a way station between Boston and New York. It was in population the seventh largest city in the continental 13 states. Norwich at that point was a great seaport because you could ship to New York and Boston through Norwich, and you didn't have any bridges to cross.
Benedict Sr. began working on cargo ships, often sailing as far as England and the West Indies to bring commodities back to Norwich. He married Hannah King, the beautiful young widow of his former boss, and took over his shipping business as well. The Arnolds began a family, but in the harsh reality of frontier New England, where illness usually meant death, only two of their six children survived.
One of those, by the way, was an older son named Benedict Arnold. He died, so because it was a family tradition that there would always be in each generation a Benedict Arnold, he was given the name of his older dead brother when he was born.
During the coldest winter in a century, Benedict Arnold V was born January 14, 1741, and proved to be stronger than his older brother. He quickly became a leader among the boys of Norwich and delighted in skating in the wintertime, fishing along the banks of the Thames River, and staging mock battles in the forests surrounding the town. Always the competitor, Arnold would challenge his friends to foot races or dare them to follow him dive off the high rocks above Yantic Falls. Often his father would take him on trading voyages to the islands of the Caribbean, and young Benedict became adept at sailing and navigation.
Benedict's mother was a very religious woman, and piety and sincerity. She taught him things that he carried all through his life. She taught him respect, especially for women. He was very conscious of women, and women made up his life. Arnold's whole being was wrapped up in his love and devotion to the women in his life.
Be dutiful to superiors, obliging to equals, and affable to inferiors, if any such there be. Always choose that your companions be your betters, that by their good examples you may learn. Keep a steady watch over your thoughts, words, and actions. Hannah Arnold, 1751.
The Arnolds, like most New Englanders, were strict Puritans and occupied the coveted first pew at the First Congregational Church in Norwich. To ensure that young Benedict received the best education possible, Hannah Arnold enrolled her 10-year-old son in the Canterbury Academy. Benedict Jr. was a good student and did well at the academy. Meanwhile, Benedict Sr. was spending less time at sea and more time downing pints of ale at local taverns. The family fell into debt and could no longer afford to keep Benedict in school. Mrs. Arnold arranged for her son to be apprenticed to a local druggist who ran the largest retail store on the Old Post Road between Boston and New York.
Hannah Arnold sent her son to a Dr. and Mrs. Lathrop, who lived in Norwich Town. He was a leading citizen in the area. They had no children of their own, and she was very sure that he would not only provide Benedict a trade, but also would provide the sort of disciplined environment that a father in those days would give to a young boy, which Benedict's father couldn't. The wife, Mrs. Lathrop, on the other hand, was also very beneficial. She had an impact on him. She taught him the social graces. She taught him how to behave in polite society.
In 1756, while Arnold lived at the Lathrops, Britain and France renewed their fight for control of North America. Eager to eradicate the hated French Catholics, New Englanders swelled the ranks of the British Army. Rambunctious young Arnold dreamed of going into battle and twice ran away to join the fight against the French, only to be called back by his mother. Finally, Dr. Lathrop let Benedict go to fight in the French and Indian War. The day before going into battle, Benedict Arnold got word that his mother had caught yellow fever and was gravely ill. Risking execution for deserting his unit, he hurried home. Hannah Arnold died soon after, and Benedict buried her next to her other children in the old Norwich Cemetery. Grieving young Benedict was now forced to become his own man. Young Benedict Arnold was saddened by the death of his mother, but his father, the once proud Captain Arnold, took Hannah's death even harder.
Captain Arnold was drunken in said Norwich, so that he was disabled in ye use of understanding and reason, appearing in his speech, posture, and behavior, which is against the peace of our Lord, ye King, and the laws of this colony. Justice of the Peace, Isaac Huntington.
After his mother's death, his father took even more increasingly to the bottle and essentially became the town drunk. His lowly status was made all the more worse by the high position he had once held in society, and it became increasingly humiliating to young Benedict. In fact, he often had to carry his father home drunk at night. And the older Arnold simply became the butt of ridicule in the town.
Benedict Arnold's father soon died. Arnold sought to escape the shame of his family's fall from grace in Norwich. And so in the spring of 1762, the 21-year-old Arnold moved to the larger town of New Haven, Connecticut. He opened a store, selling primarily drugs and books, and kept the store stocked with a wide variety of items obtained on merchant voyages to London.
He did that and was fairly successful until the turmoil of the era caught up, and a lot of the merchants, the shop owners, had trouble as the tax situation changed. He went into trading and fell back on what his father had done and what he had learned as a young man and what he had been doing for Dr. Lathrop out of Norwich Town, and became a very successful trader because he knew so much about the business.
Arnold was an aggressive sea captain, hauling livestock to the West Indies, liquor and raw materials to Britain, and finished goods and luxuries back across the Atlantic for sale in Arnold's own store in New Haven. The confident young man furnished his home in the style of a wealthy Englishman and gazed with pride out his window to the bustling harbor. The ambitious Arnold soon became one of New Haven's leading citizens, as well as one of its most eligible bachelors. In 1763, he married Margaret Mansfield, the beautiful daughter of the High Sheriff of New Haven County. He was very much in love with his new bride, who bore him three children. But now he was required to spend more time at sea. England's latest new tax made it increasingly difficult for Arnold and other American businessmen to turn a profit.
when England decided to tax the colonies to help pay the bills of keeping the army over here, the British Army, which had been put here, left here after the French and Indian Wars, they came up with a whole series of taxes that they kept trying. The British Parliament decided that they would levy taxes through stamps on all kinds of products. But there again, the turmoil of the era caused him difficulties, and he, like so many other New England traders, became smugglers. Smuggling was not so much considered to be a crime against the British as it was clever, a way to avoid these unjust, unfair taxes.
Smuggling is riveted in the constitution of the inhabitants of Connecticut as much as superstition and religion, and their province is a storehouse for the smugglers of the neighboring colonies. The Reverend Samuel Peters.
As the British moved to enforce these taxes, riots broke out in several New England towns, including New Haven. In 1770, British troops opened fire on an unruly mob in what came to be known as the Boston Massacre. 3 years later, Americans threw cargo overboard in Boston Harbor in a protest known as the Boston Tea Party.
Benedict Arnold saw himself during these times of trouble as the country was drifting toward independence as one of the rebels, as one of the people fighting for, or preparing to fight for, prepared to argue for American rights. He saw himself at first doing that locally in New Haven. He was a member of the militia and was elected early in 1775 the captain of the New Haven Company. So he saw himself as a leader, he was. He saw himself as a radical, he was. He saw himself as an aggravated merchant and trader, which he was.
Tensions finally exploded in April 1775 when British regulars and Massachusetts militiamen fired at each other in Lexington and Concord. The Revolutionary War had begun. Word spread like wildfire through the cities and towns of New England, and 34-year-old Benedict Arnold was ready.
He immediately responded. He said this was war. In New Haven, they said, let us all go to church and pray for the king. The king, King George III, was a certified card-carrying wacko. He was not of sound mind. Arnold knew this can't go on. We're going to have to fight. And so while the conservatives went to church to pray for the king, Arnold went to the powder keg to get the powder to march on Boston. He was a man of action.
Conservatives in New Haven, led by David Wooster, feared a conflict with England and refused to hand over muskets and gunpowder to Arnold and his men. Wearing the scarlet coats of the 2nd Connecticut Foot Guard, they assembled in the square as Arnold demanded the ammunition they would need to fight the British.
This is colony property. We cannot give it up without regular orders from those in authority. David Wooster.
Regular orders be damned. Our friends and neighbors are being mowed down by redcoats. Give us the powder, or we will take it. None but Almighty God shall prevent my marching. Benedict Arnold.
When Arnold and his 50 men got to Lexington, they joined the throng of thousands of militia who, like him and his people, spontaneously had marched from all over New England to resist the redcoats. At that time, there was no Continental Army. It was just a spontaneous uprising. There was no single leader. It was a mob, truly, a mob of milling militia. Arnold, seeing that nothing was going to happen there, recalled that there were cannon in Fort Ticonderoga in upper state New York, where he had been as a young man, where he had come as a trader. He talked the Massachusetts authorities into making him a colonel and giving him authority to raise troops and go capture Fort Ticonderoga and grab the cannon.
And off he went to Ticonderoga, where he suddenly found himself face to face with one of the more, unusual characters of the Revolution, Ethan Allen. And there was a clash of giant egos right there on the spot. So Arnold and Allen met and they had a terrible wrangle. Who was going to command and so forth? Donald had a commission, but Allen had the men. So they finally decided they'd attack together. So they did attack side by side, and of course it was a joke. I mean, they captured the thing without firing a shot, hardly. But they had done this really remarkable thing. They had captured this fort, which was sent a great inrush of confidence through the whole country. Maybe we can beat these guys if we can capture Ticonderoga. And so Arnold was instantly catapulted to hero status.
Arnold said, "My God, they don't know there's a war on." And he immediately communicates with General Washington. And he said, "If we invade Canada now and make them the 14th state, we can capture Canada before they know there's a war." He was absolutely right.
The American colonies are in danger from Canada, whether in the hands of the British or restored to the French. Benedict Arnold to the Continental Congress, 1775.
When Arnold returned home from Ticonderoga, he learned that his wife had died. Now the single father of three boys, Arnold put them in the care of his sister Hannah and turned his attention north. His goal was to push the British off the continent entirely and put Canada on the side of American independence.
At that time, Canada was a river and two cities. You got the St. Lawrence River and the cities of Quebec and Montreal. Seaports, really, because traders with ocean-going ships would sail all the way in to the two. The rest of Canada was a vast wilderness filled with trappers, but no real settlements, nothing, just those two cities. So what the Americans wanted to do to make Canada the 14th colony was to capture Quebec, capture Montreal, and they would have the 14th colony in their control.
Arnold began a trek through the frigid wilderness of Maine, in an epic journey known as the March to Quebec, in which he led 1,000 men 380 miles up the treacherous Kennebec River. Waterfalls and swift currents forced the men to have to carry their boats upstream for much of the way.
You would have taken the men for amphibious animals, as they were a great part of the time underwater. Benedict Arnold, October 1775.
The Americans almost starved to death along the way and were helped by friendly Indians who dubbed Benedict Arnold the Dark Eagle. Finally reaching the fortress city on the icy St. Lawrence River in December 1775, Arnold held the future of Canada in the palm of his hand.
Arnold's prong was to surprise Quebec, to come in through the woods from a direction they wouldn't necessarily be looking. They would have been looking up and down the St. Lawrence River. However, the other prong, led by an American named Montgomery, a general, Richard Montgomery, did succeed in taking Montreal, and he came down the river, and he and Arnold joined forces and waited for a snowstorm to give them surprise to go into the city. That snowstorm came, the blizzard, on the final day of 1775.
In simultaneous attacks, Arnold and Montgomery charged opposite ends of Quebec City. Montgomery's troops stalled just before scaling the wall of the lower city, enabling the British to fire rounds of grapeshot down at the helpless men. Montgomery was mortally wounded and died at the foot of the Great Wall as his men ran for their lives. Arnold stormed the palace gate and took his fight to the city's narrow, winding streets. Not knowing Montgomery's fate, Arnold was pinned down by the British, who were not surprised by the attack.
And it all fell on Arnold. Though he got into the city, he couldn't quite carry it through. He tried desperately, and in the process, with the British lining the windows, firing down into the streets, he was hit in the leg and had to be borne from the scene.
Arnold was forced back across the border into New York. With thousands of British reinforcements pouring into Canada, the Americans took a defensive stance at the newly acquired Fort Ticonderoga on the banks of Lake Champlain.
If you look at the situation in 1776, the British forces are at the northern part of Lake Champlain, the American forces at the southern part. Whoever controls the lake is going to have a fleet. Neither had a fleet. The British brought pieces overland and began to assemble the boats at the northern part. Arnold was put in charge of the lake, but they really had to build the warships. They set up docks, shipyards, and sort of a backwoods arm race began, with the Americans building war vessels at the south, the British building fighting ships at the north. They both finished about the same time. Arnold got his and sailed north about the time the British were sailing south. They met in the middle at a battle called the Battle of Valcour Island.
Although the opposing navies blasted away at each other for hours, Arnold's fleet was positioned between the island and the shore and was protected from the full force of British cannons. With no experienced sailors on the American side, Benedict Arnold took it upon himself to serve as admiral as well as cannoneer.
We suffered much for want of seamen and gunners. I was obliged myself to point most of the guns on board the Congress, which I believe did good execution. Benedict Arnold.
He fought a defensive battle. He did quite a lot of damage to the British. They did a hell of a lot more damage to him. They sank almost his entire fleet. But again, what courage. Practically every other man on his ship is dead or wounded. And he's up on the prow of the ship, firing this cannon all by himself, ignoring these swarms of cannonballs and bullets flying all around him. So the British, as a result of this terrific defense, went back to Canada. And this really gave us a breathing space of at least 9 to 12 months, which was absolutely crucial.
Despite his heroics and brilliant leadership in combat, the Continental Congress refused to recognize Arnold, and he was denied the promotion that he so richly deserved. Feeling as though his government had slapped him in the face, Arnold went back to New Haven to prepare his resignation. But the war would follow him home.
He was in Connecticut, and the British invaded Connecticut, and they marched 2,000 men inland to attack Danbury, which was a big storehouse for the Continental Army. And his estate was thousands and thousands of people on the militia rolls. These guys were able to march right through the middle of the state. Nobody fired a shot at them until they got to Danbury. They burned everything they could find there. Danbury did a lot of really serious damage there. And then they started marching back.
Benedict Arnold led a group of local militiamen that fought the British all the way back to the sea. The inexperienced civilians inflicted heavy casualties on the King's army. And as a result, the Continental Congress was embarrassed into promoting Benedict Arnold to Major General.
My commission was conferred unsolicited and received with pleasure only as a means of serving my country. With equal pleasure, I resign it when I can no longer serve my country with honor. When I entered the service of my country, my character was unimpeached. Yet even personal injury shall be buried in my zeal for the safety and happiness of my country, in whose cause I have repeatedly fought and bled, and am ready at all times to risk my life. Benedict Arnold, 1776.
Although the Continental Congress did make Benedict Arnold a major general, five junior officers who had received promotions before him still had seniority over him. Arnold was not satisfied and proceeded to turn in his resignation.
The day he turned in his resignation, a letter arrived from Washington saying he needed Arnold in the north. He needed him in northern New York, where the British were about to invade. Arnold withdrew his resignation and headed north. That was really what Arnold was waiting for. He wanted to fight.
A large British army under the command of the Playboy General Johnny Burgoyne were planning an invasion that would once and for all crush the Continental Army and secure the eastern seaboard for the Empire.
The British objectives in 1777 were very simple. to cut the United States in half along the line of the Hudson River. One force would come from Canada down Lake Champlain to Albany to the Hudson River. One would attack north out of New York City. And when they had the line of the Hudson, as they called it, they would have isolated New England, which they considered to be the hotbed of rebellion. Arnold's job, along with all the army in the north, was to block, blunt, stop the British invasion out of Canada coming south.
The Americans were under the command of Horatio Gates, unlike Arnold, a man unwilling to fight and lead his troops into battle. Major General Arnold had taken it upon himself to engage the British and had so far been successful. However, on the final day at Saratoga, with victory or defeat in the balance, Gates had confined Arnold to his tent.
The Americans and the British fought, and it became sort of a standoff. Arnold, though, was chomping at the bit to get into it. He finally couldn't contain himself. He jumped on his horse, rode to the battle, and with no command authority at all except his presence, and people knew who he was, he took command of the battle himself and led attack after attack into the British lines, miraculously was never touched. And finally, as the sun was setting, he led a charge that broke the British lines. And as he rode into the British lines, his horse was shot down, and a musket ball entered his leg, shattering the thigh, and Arnold fell as the sun fell.
Carried from the battlefield, terribly wounded, Arnold was immediately placed under arrest for having disobeyed orders. But the day is won. Burgoyne is finished. His army is soon forced to surrender. It's clear to Burgoyne, it's clear to everyone on the battlefield that Benedict Arnold has won the day. Clear to everyone except Horatio Gates. He denies Arnold credit. He accepts Burgoyne's sword. He accepts credit for America's greatest victory. Arnold, while the glory goes to Gates, lays in a hospital tent while doctors ponder whether to cut his leg off or not. Glory is turning increasingly bitter to Benedict Arnold.
The magnificent American victory inspired the French to declare war on England and become allies with the colonies. Confined to a hospital bed and not happy with the idea of now being an ally of Catholic France, Arnold recovered slowly. With the victory at Saratoga, his country needed him more than ever, and George Washington knew it.
As soon as your situation will permit, I request that you will repair to this army. It is my earnest wish to have your services for the ensuing campaign. George Washington.
Arnold, by this time, was Washington's favorite general. He just adored the guy. And he wanted to do things to make him happy. And he wanted to give him a command which had some prestige and yet didn't require him to do anything that would cause his bad leg to be hurt again or anything like that. So he made him military commander of Philadelphia just after the British retreated from Philadelphia as a result of the French alliance. When the British heard that the French were allied with America and were sending a fleet to America, they realized that they couldn't defend both Philadelphia and New York. So they decided to leave Philadelphia and retreat to New York. So Arnold took over a city that had just been occupied by the British for over a year, and it was a city in chaos.
Arnold walked a fine line between loyalists and patriots in Philadelphia, and as a result was resented by both. He took full advantage of his position as military governor, using his skills as a businessman to make a lot of money, and enthusiastically joined the ranks of the city's social elite. At one of the many parties and balls he attended, the 38-year-old Arnold met a young girl 20 years his junior who would change his life forever.
Peggy Shippen was the beautiful, vivacious, charming daughter of one of the most prominent loyalist families in Philadelphia. She had been the belle of Philadelphia society during the British occupation. She had been besieged by many young officers who had courted her, including Clinton's aide, the handsome, dashing John Andre. And now she caught the fancy of Benedict Arnold, who laid siege to her with a passion, with a madness that equaled his actions at Saratoga.
Cupid has given our little general a more mortal wound than all the host of Britons could. Mrs. Robert Morris, 1778.
And all of a sudden, this beautiful girl, Peggy Shippen, the prettiest girl in Philadelphia, she likes him. That's strange right on the face of it. Here is a broken man, crippled from combat, 38 years old, and here is this 18-year-old beauty. She loves him. Peggy Shippen is in the employ of British espionage. There's a plot, and a very sinister plot. Arnold was to the British what Rama was to the English, what Patton was to the German. In other words, a general who could defeat them. The British wanted Arnold out of there. Without Arnold, they'd win.
To prove to Peggy's father that he was serious about his daughter and about staying in Philadelphia, Arnold put a down payment on the 96-acre estate of Mount Pleasant and moved into the elegant mansion, formerly the home of General William Howe during the British occupation. 2 weeks later, Benedict Arnold and Peggy Shippen were married.
In the winter of 78, the spring of 79, in Arnold's heart, it all came to a head. All of the troubles he had had with backstabbing fellow officers, all the troubles he had had with failure to be recognized by the Continental Congress for his great achievements on the battlefield, his need for money, his relationship with a young woman who had loyalist intents. And somewhere in there, somewhere in that winter, he had decided that he was going to turn his coat. He was no longer going to support the Patriot cause, but to support the British. Only weeks after his marriage, he makes the first attempts to contact the British commander to find a way to join the British.
Arnold supplied information to the British for over a year, sending messages through Peggy and taking advantage of her relationship with British Major John Andre. Devising a scheme to end the war and line his own pockets, Arnold offered the British the keystone of the American cause, the fort guarding the Hudson River at West Point.
West Point was not just a strategic spot. West Point was the strategic spot in the American Revolution. Both sides, British and Americans, agreed on one thing, that if the British could ever capture the line of the Hudson, they would probably win the war.
If I point out a plan of cooperation by which Sir Henry shall possess himself of West Point, the garrison, etc., etc., £20,000 sterling, I think, will be a cheap purchase for an object of so much importance. I expect a full and explicit answer. Benedict Arnold, letter to the British General, Henry Clinton.
2 weeks after Arnold's offer to the British, Washington appointed him commander of America's most strategic spot.
As the commander, Arnold now has to find a way to communicate with the British. He needs to give them the plans to West Point. He needs to tell them how to attack. So Arnold and Clinton set that up between Andre and Arnold in the middle of the night along the shores of the Hudson River.
Arnold and Andre talked for hours on the banks of the Hudson. As dawn broke, American artillery opened fire on the British warship Vulture, which had ferried Andre up the river from New York. With daylight increasing, Andre put the plans in his boots, donned civilian clothes, and received a pass signed by Arnold to get him through the American lines. In unfamiliar country, Andre was set upon by highwaymen, common thieves, who came across the maps and plans signed by Arnold, and in a flash of patriotism turned the young spy over to American troops in the area. When the American commander saw what John Andre had with him, he was suspicious. But Benedict Arnold was the commander of West Point and should be notified. He sent messengers to Arnold and to George Washington, who was scheduled to meet with Arnold that very morning.
Sitting there waiting for Washington to arrive, Arnold is confident that Andre is safe back in New York City. He's at his table when a messenger comes in, and it's a messenger from
his officer who had captured Andre. And he sent along the information of Andre's capture and the kind of incriminating evidence he had. And he also said, I have sent that evidence to General Washington. So now Arnold knows Andre's caught. The evidence is on the way to Washington. Washington is on the way to visit Arnold.
Arnold quickly told Peggy that they had been caught and instructed his oarsmen to row him out to the Vulture. Meanwhile, Washington arrived at Arnold's house, expecting to have breakfast with his favorite general.
When he gets there, the message just arrives with all the papers that show Arnold is a traitor. And he knows that Arnold has, just by that thin a margin, missed turning West Point over to the British.
Whom can we trust now? George Washington.
Arnold escaped to New York, and his wife Peggy threw a tantrum that convinced Washington that she was not involved in the plot. John Andre was not so lucky. Although admired by his captors, only a trade for Benedict Arnold would save his life. Convicted of being a spy, he was sentenced to hang.
Well, there are estimates of 1,000 people present. There was just one request he had. That instead of being hanged, a humiliating means of departure from this life, he'd be shot. But Washington went along with the verdict, and he was hanged. He struggled briefly, dangling, and then he was dead.
Had his plan succeeded, it must have put an end to the war. General Arnold did but just escape, and upon his arrival in New York, was appointed a brigadier general in our service by Sir Henry. Had the scheme answered, no rank would have overpaid so important a service. British Lieutenant George Matthew.
What would be my fate if I should be taken prisoner? Benedict Arnold.
They will cut off that leg of yours wounded at Quebec and at Saratoga and bury it with all the honors of war, and then hang the rest of you on a gibbet. Captured American officer.
Benedict Arnold became a brigadier general in the British Army. He was not trusted by his fellow officers and was not able to lead the King's soldiers as well as he had the Americans. This lack of respect led to disastrous circumstances. Unwilling to obey the orders of a traitor, the British made a frontal assault of Fort Griswold. The attack was suicide, and bitter British troops slaughtered captured Americans and torched the town of New London, Connecticut, burning it to the ground.
When it was all done, there was nothing but dead bodies everywhere, and for nothing. So Arnold then, it was then, I think, more than ever that the country said he's an evil man.
Let his name sink as low in infamy as it was once high in our esteem. On this stage, all good men will unite in execrating his memory to the latest posterity. Even villains less guilty than himself will not cease to upbraid him. And though they approve the treason, they will despise the traitor. Lieutenant Colonel Eleazar Oswald, 1780.
Unable to lead British troops, and with the Parliament preparing to scale down its war with the colonies, Benedict Arnold left for England. He became an advisor to King George, but was never trusted or even liked by the nation to whom he defected.
Arnold's years in England were rather sad. He was regarded by the British, unfortunately, as a traitor. Although they took very good care of him. They gave Peggy a pension for life. Arnold himself had a very good pension from the British Crown, but he never felt accepted in British society to the level, of course, of acceptance that he thought he should achieve.
After the war, Peggy Arnold remained a loyal, loving wife to her husband. However, back in the newly independent United States, Benedict Arnold was hated as much as ever.
There are several
examples where the very name Benedict Arnold has been removed from history. Right after his treason, George Washington decreed that the name Benedict Arnold would never be mentioned again in anything written about the army or about the country.
They actually went to the cemetery in Norwich and they removed the father's gravestone and his brother, who had been born and died before him. And at Saratoga today, they have a monument to Benedict Arnold's left leg, but they don't have his name. The monument says, to the most gallant warrior in the Continental Army. And then on a wooden plaque outside a wrought iron fence, it says the monument within is the memory of Benedict Arnold, because there is a law in America passed by the Congress that you can neither chisel the name Benedict Arnold or mold it in metal. So, I mean, they took this guy right off the face of the earth.
Hated in America and shunned in Britain, Arnold became afflicted with a nervous disorder which would eventually take his life. Knowing that the end was near, Arnold asked Peggy to help him put on his old Continental uniform one last time.
Let me die in my old American uniform, the uniform in which I fought my battles. God forgive me for ever putting on any other. Benedict Arnold, 1801.
Benedict Arnold died in London on June 14, 1801. Soon after, 44-year-old Peggy Arnold died as well, and they were both laid to rest at the Cathedral of Battersea. The legend of America's greatest traitor did not die, and the scorn that Americans felt for him did not diminish even long after the war.
The fact that it still exists today probably tells us that the values of loyalty, of country, of patriotism are still important and are still deep. You go to West Point, the site that Arnold was trying to sell. What is the motto? Duty, honor, country. Arnold fell flat in all three.
The Dark Eagle comes to claim the wilderness. The wilderness will yield to the Dark Eagle, but the rock will defy him. The Dark Eagle will soar aloft to the sun. Nations will behold him and sound his praises. Yet when he soars highest, his fall is most certain. When his wings brush the sky, then the arrow will pierce his heart. Natanis, chief of the Abenaki tribe, upon first meeting Benedict Arnold.